This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. I have a very special guest today on the show, Bob Gutkowski, who is the founder of RMG Sports Ventures and the former president of Madison Square Garden and MSG Network. And his innovative ideas led to the creation of the Yes Network and Live Nation. And Bob is out with a new book telling his story of his wonderful career and behind the scenes. It's called Gut Punch, written with the help of Wallace Matthews, the New York journalist. Bob, what a pleasure to have you on Sports Jam.
Well, thanks, Doug. It's certainly my pleasure for sure. I've been wanting to do this for a while and excited about it.
Absolutely. And this is the book right here, Gut Punch. And you definitely will want to check this book out, especially if, not only if you're a sports fan, but a sports broadcasting fan, because all the names that I've mentioned that have come into play in Bob's life, it's a history book as well as, you know, as your story. It's a history of sports television that goes through it. But it all started out for Bob as a page at NBC. How often do you think of those days? Because you were a part of some of the most recognized television shows ever, including The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Yeah, I think about it quite often. It was really my springboard. It was created because it was back in 1970 when we had a little thing called Vietnam, and there was a draft, and I had a high number, so I did not go, but a lot of my friends did. And, you know, it always is always in the back of your mind. One, how difficult a period that was, and number two, how it was really the beginning of the ladder that you were about to climb, even though you didn't know where it was going.
This book opens up, by the way, the foreword from Marv Albert. We're going to talk about Marv in just a couple of minutes. It opens up with you hoisting the Stanley Cup, the Rangers' amazing victory in 1994 that was so long anticipated and craved by Ranger fans around the world.
The waiting is over! The New York Rangers are the Stanley Cup champions! And this one will last a lifetime! No more curses! This is unbelievable! These people have waited a long time! Fans, players, coaches! Unbelievable! Let the celebration begin!
I have a cup back there, Mike Richter's mask, as he was part of that championship, just to celebrate this moment for you. Obviously, this was a huge highlight for you. You had just really started your career as president of Madison Square Garden when the Rangers win the cup. And the book tells about all these things that were going on behind the scenes. But for you, this was the pinnacle of a wonderful sports career that resulted in you hoisting Lord Stanley.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think in all honesty, I became president in 91, and we almost won that year, but we lost to a lucky Pittsburgh Penguin team, I thought. And at that point, I thought I was going to win the cup, you know, 6 months into my journey, but we didn't win, and we took a couple years later. But you know, for a kid growing up in New York, who was a Ranger fan, you know, from day one, who skated the streets of Uniondale, Long Island as Andy Bathgate, it was incredible to think that I was involved and participated in an incredible group that won the Stanley Cup. And my name is on it, so my grandchildren will get to see it, my children, and that I'm very proud of.
In Gut Punch, and we'll talk about the reason for that title as well, because I think it's really fitting, because you gave gut punches and received gut punches, and your nickname, obviously, Gut. When it comes to winning the cup, the whole negotiations between Neil Smith and head coach Mike Keenan, that was a very tumultuous season for the Rangers, even though a lot of people don't realize what was going on between the two. You called them both into a meeting, and that really kind of calmed the tension. Without that meeting, you even admit, you might not have been hoisting Stanley Cup that night.
Yeah, that's true. It's certainly my belief, and will always be my belief, that meeting was integral in us getting the cup. It got to a point where neither coach nor general manager were talking to each other. This was in March. It started in late January, and I became very aware of it. And I got a call a day or two before the trading deadline from Mike Keenan's agent. And he had told me that Mike wanted to go on record to let me know that he believed the team was not good enough. The general manager believed it was, but they were not speaking. And he just wanted to make sure that if they didn't want to win the cup, he wouldn't be held accountable. So in some way, it was a bit of a cleansing. And the other way, and in another way, it was really kind of a bit of an alarm that something has to happen here. And I felt I had to put him in a room. As you know, Doug, the Gardner's being sold, so everybody was sort of nervous and uncomfortable. It was a bit of a difficult position. But I think putting those guys face to face, making sure they got in the room together, was going to be important if we're ever going to have a chance to win a cup. You know, we were leading the league for a long time and then hit a pretty rough spot in March. And the Devils were right behind us. And I just thought it was a, we had to have a coming to Jesus meeting and force both of them, although Keenan really didn't give me any headwind on it, but Neil did. But forced them both into this office. Off my desk, off my conference room, off my office, put them at different sides of the table, opened it up and said that I got a real problem here and there's only one guy getting that he gets screwed because the garden's being sold and I know that's me. And we're going to sit here and we're going to figure out what we have to do to win the cup. And I'm going to start it off. I have a coach that thinks the team is not good enough. I got a general manager who thinks the team is good enough. You guys do not talk to each other. I believe the team is not good enough. We're going to sit here and figure out what we want to do. And I started off. And at that point, I said, Mike, I want you to you start first. And, you know, Mike said, the first thing, Neil, is I don't want your job. And I jumped in and said, Mike, come on, please. You know, it's being written. Whether you want it or not, you're not going to get it. And Neil said, I don't really have a problem with that. And I said, Neil, yes, you do. Of course you do. I would have a problem too if I read that my coach wants my job. But nothing's happening. And we're going to sit here and figure it out. And Mike said, you know, I'm like a chef. A baker, I know when I need more sugar in the icing. And I said, yeah, that's a pretty fair point. But how's the general manager going to know it needs sugar if you don't talk to him and he doesn't talk to you? So we're going to figure out how much sugar we need. And they started, and Mike started what he needed, the problems. Neil got into it. And all of a sudden, they were in this marvelous, deep hockey conversation to the point where about 45 minutes into it, I got up and I left. It was going to be them working it out together. And I walked down the aisle to my office and my Monty Begley, who was my executive VP of communications, I sat down from across to her, put my feet up on a desk, and I said, Monty, if we ever win a cup, it's going to be because of this meeting. And after the meeting, it was about a 3-hour meeting, Doug. I'm in my office. Neil Smith pokes his head in, says, Bob, I really thank you for that. I didn't think it was going to work, but it did. I know what Mike wants. I'm going to go out and get it. And he did. And, you know, the beauty of it in so many ways was that Neil was a good general manager. Neil could get the most out of something. Mike had to tell him that. And Neil went off and made some great trades that ultimately, I think, was the reason why we won the Stanley Cup.
There was something special about Gutt because he was able to, throughout the years, establish relationships with some of the biggest names in sports broadcasting and became lifelong friends with many that we will talk about in this edition of Sports Jam. What was it about this tuxedo-wearing man that had this beard and always dressed impeccably and led to some of your jobs? First of all, tell the people why you wore the tuxedo during the Stanley Cup run, beginning with game two, and why it became synonymous with you on the ice when you hoisted the cup.
Yeah, that's a great question. That was a marvelous backstory. Wally Matthews, who wrote this book with me, felt that I wore it because I was just obnoxious. I was a suit and just wanted to show off. And part of that was true, but the other part of it, there was a real story. And we had gotten to the finals against, or semifinals against New Jersey. And going into the first game against the Devils, and we had beaten the Devils 6-0 in the regular season, which was very concerning to me personally, because it's very hard to keep that going, especially against a team like the Devils. So we lost the first game at home, So the next game was going to be very important, but a dear friend of mine who is in the book, a mentor of mine, he was a partner of mine named Mike Traeger, was getting married, and he had a black tie party, pre-party at 21 that night, which is a great legendary restaurant, but it was black tie. So I went in my tuxedo, left early, went to the garden, and we won the second game. And there I am sitting in my tuxedo and people coming down because I had a good rapport with the fans saying, Bob, you have to wear that tuxedo game three, you know. I said, don't be ridiculous, you know. So the next day, my assistants, Tina, got inundated with telephone calls about is Bob wearing the tuxedo? So game three was in New Jersey. I could not go because I had a commitment on Long Island with my wife prior to the game. And we went to the event, came back to my house. I was laying in bed, and with a few minutes to go, the Devils tied the score. And if we had lost that game, I thought that was going to be the end of the run. So I went into my closet, put everything on my tuxedo, including socks and patent leather shoes, and I laid in my bed watching the last few minutes. My wife, Laura, comes in and says, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, I got to see if this tuxedo works, you know? And the Rangers wound up winning the game. And that was it. I wore the tuxedo for the rest of the run. So it worked for the Rangers, didn't work for the Knicks, but it certainly worked for the Rangers. So that's the reason why I wore tuxedo every day.
We had Stephan Matteau recently on Sports Jam talking about the wonderful games that he had against the Devils and the thrilling overtime goal. And he told the funny story about Howie Rose and how he wasn't, was hanging around and taking pictures. And Stephan said, "I like you, Howie, but why are we taking all these pictures together?" And he goes, "Well, the call." He goes, "What call?" Stefan had not heard the call until like 4 months later did he hear Howie Rose's famous
Oh,
call,
really?
Mateau, Mateau, Mateau. Yeah.
It was a great call by Howie for sure.
Kachisov for the Devils plays it cross ice into the far corner. Mateau swoops in to intercept. Mateau behind the net. Swings it in front. He scores! Mateau! 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 Defend Mateau! And the Rangers have one more hill to climb, baby! But it's Moose Vancouver!
The rise to become president of Madison Square Garden is one that you'll definitely want to read in Gut Punch. There are many names that I could pull out that were mentors, still friends of yours through the years, reasons why you got certain jobs. But one in particular stood out to me because, as I mentioned to you before, I'm a Pittsburgh fan, and Joe Garagiola did play for the Pirates at one time. And early on, Joe took a liking to Bob Gutkowski. Tell us about that.
I was a page coming out of college, which was about $90 a week, and I had great legendary stories to it. But for me, I was getting married, so it was a bit of a difficult issue. But you couldn't get a job because of Vietnam. So I was a page, and I was a page on one of the shows at NBC called He Said, She Said.
The lovely ladies are here. Good. All right. Gonna get right to it now. You see what happens. We're gonna see if your husbands can recognize you by the stories you're gonna tell us about your married life, right? And your husbands are backstage, and they can only hear us when we want them to, like this. Hello, guys. Did you press your buttons? Where's Hal Holbrook? There he is. All right.
And the host was Joe Garagiola, who was the most wonderful guy in the world. He would talk to everybody the same way, talk to pages. He would always come up and do something face to face with you. So one day I asked Joe, I had heard that NBC had a sports department, and I said, boy, I would love to get into the sports business, television business. And I asked Joe, could we have breakfast? And he goes, absolutely. I'll see you tomorrow at 7 o'clock at X Place, and we'll have a breakfast. And we had this wonderful breakfast. We paid for it. And he was very helpful in me getting to meet Chet Simmons. I got to meet the president, Carl Lindemann of NBC Sports, through a various other relationship. But Joe was always terrific. And we always had this marvelous relationship. You know, whenever I would see him in and out of NBC, it was, Gutkowski, you in sports yet? For God's sakes, you know, what's taking you so long, you know? And then we went full circle in our relationship. And I wanted, when MSG got the, MSG Network got the Yankees, I wanted to hire Joe as my play-by-play guy. Or analyst, either one. But he didn't want to do it. He was at it today at that particular point, going to Arizona, but loved it. But said to me, God, if you ever have an opening in the dog show, I would love to host it. And I said, absolutely. So we got him to host the dog show for a couple of years, and he was terrific. And I spoke to Joe almost up until his death. So he was a very important person in my life. But I will tell you, he was one of the great people that got put on the face of the earth, Joe Garagiola.
And also great friends with Yogi Berra through all those years growing up in the same neighborhood. Joe was certainly a special guy and loved by so many. Some of the other people that are really a major part of your career, Mike Traeger and Chet Simmons, what do you want to say about them?
Well, really two outstanding individuals, but two outstanding sports executives that I learned a great deal from. And Chet was the president of NBC Sports. Mike was the VP of sports sales, and Mike hired me in sports sales and eventually left and went to sports programming under Chet. And then Chet left. What happened was I was offered a job at ABC Sports by also another legendary name guy, John Lazarus, and I was going to take it, but they both convinced me not to go because I wanted to move from sales to programming. And within 3 or 4 months after that, Chet left to go to ESPN, and Mike left to go to Anheuser-Busch. So my two mentors who convinced me not to leave to go to ABC left me in about 3 or 4 months after that. So, but we remained great friends, and I was a friend of Chet's until his death, and Mike and I are still great friends. And as you know, Chet did an incredible job, one at NBC, but certainly at building ESPN in the early days. And Mike, in my estimation, saved ESPN when he went to Anheuser-Busch and made an early 5-year, $25 million deal. That was the lifeline. I don't believe ESPN would be around today if it wasn't for Chet Simmons and Mike Traeger.
And Gut Punch. It is made very clear that Wallace Matthews, who wrote this book with you, he said when he was writing that, I don't know, does everybody need to know the story of Bob Gutkowski, this guy that was hoisting the cup? And do people really know what his story is? It's an amazing story that really shows from the days as a page to becoming this wonderful sports executive who had great ideas. And unfortunately, we find out in the book, not all those ideas does he get all the full credit or get the compensation for some of these ideas that you came up with. One of the things that I really enjoy about the book too is the intertwining of your family, your wife, Laura, your children, and how, you know, this all impacted them, right? They were fans of the teams that you were part of. And she had to always deal with this kind of gambler, this guy who would take some chances and had to take some chances in order for your career to move forward. That relationship means a great deal to you, doesn't it?
It does, without a doubt. I mean, we all love our families. We all have most of us great relationships with our wives and our children. Mine was, it was a difficult road in that, you know, I was gone a lot and I was on the road a lot. I had a high pressure situation, but my wife was a tremendous supporter, great corporate lady, great corporate wife. And my kids were just sports fans. They loved it. My daughter worked for the NBA for 23 years, and it was our way, this incredible way for her and I to relate to each other through sport. And Christian and Matthew were more artistically and musically bent, but we had a very close knit family. And on the cup, winning the cup and being on the float together was a great family experience.
You lost your son, Christian, in 2023, and sure had a major impact on you. What do you want to say about that?
You know, for anybody who's lost a child, it is the greatest body blow that you will ever have. I mean, you are no longer the individual you once were because he's gone. But you think of him every single day. He had tremendous influence on my life. I loved him dearly. He was an incredible boy that, you know, just cared about people more than he cared about himself. And he was a frustrated artist in many things, but he loved his family greatly. He was really the impetus for me to finish this thing, Doug. You know, it's been, Wally and I wrote it for a couple of years. You know, we didn't get it sold, so I decided to self-publish it. But Christian's death, really, because he wanted me to finish this book, was so important that, you know, we just picked it up right after that and got sat down and called everything we did years prior and put it all together and said, we're going to do this. So I think of him every day. He was a tremendous part of my life and will always be a tremendous part of it.
Very touching comments near the end of Gut Punch that really put it into perspective for Bob Gutkowski. He would give everything back if he could just have one more day with his son, Christian. And our condolences go to you for that tragic loss. Mike Tyson's been a guest on Sports Jam, and we had a wonderful time together. You knew Mike Tyson was a ticket to success for the network.
In the red corner, he's ranked number 4 heavyweight by the World Boxing Council. He's undefeated in 21 professional fights. 19 of those fights, 19 fights, ended in KOs. 12 of them in the very first round. He is the most exciting heavyweight the world has been waiting for. The undefeated Mike Tyson from Catskill, New York. His weight is 217 pounds.
And you never gave up on pushing to have Mike Tyson as a fighter. Talk a little bit about how that was important to bring Mike Tyson to the television screen when you were getting some pushback about, you know, maybe some other fighters deserve more time.
Yeah. When I was the VP of program for ESPN, we started a second boxing series called Saturday Night the Fights. And Bob Arum, when I got there, had an exclusive for boxing at ESPN, and I wanted to break that. And I started this second series. And it really opened up our dialogue with so many different promoters and managers. And I got to know Jimmy Jacobs and Bill Caton. They had an incredible lightweight called Edwin Rosario that we put on ESPN, and he was a terrific fighter. And when I left ESPN, I went to Paramount, who owned Madison Square Garden. And I started to read in various magazines about this kid upstate named Mike Tyson, 17-year-old kid. But I was fascinated because he was managed by Cus D'Amato, who is legendary in boxing lore as a manager. And, he had so many different, you know, different terrific fighters, Floyd Patterson, Jose Torres. And he was managed by Jimmy Jacobs and Bill Caton. And Jimmy and Bill I knew at ESPN. And Jimmy was this incredible handball player in the United States, maybe the best ever. And so when I started this, I couldn't bring Tyson to ESPN. He was too young. But when I went to Madison Square Garden, I wanted to bring him to New York. He had never fought in New York. He had not gone beyond the first round, I don't believe. He had about 17 or 18 fights. So I called Jimmy. And first I went down to the boxing department, John Condon and Harold Weston, and said, you know, I'm fascinated by this story here because of the people involved with this kid. I'd like to bring him to New York, Felt Forum, that's what it was called at that point, and I'd like to put him on MSG Network. And at that point, the Felt Forum was, you know, once or twice a month having fights, 300 or 400 people showed up. It was not very good. And they said, well, he's a 4-round fighter in our estimation. You know, he's only worth $2,500. Michael Breland, fought a couple of weeks before that and fought for $5,000. His manager was a legendary guy named Shelly Finkel. So I had breakfast with Jimmy Jacobs, and Jimmy said, look, Robert, he always called me Robert. We would love nothing better than to do to bring Michael to, it was Mark Breland, not Mike Breland, I apologize. We would like to bring Michael to New York, but he is an 8-round fighter. He's not a 4-round fighter. I will not fight for a penny less or a penny more than Mark Breland fought for 2 weeks to 3 weeks ago, which was $5,000. And if you can get that done, we would like nothing better to bring young Michael to the Fell Forum. So I went back to Condon. He was adamant, 4 rounds, 2,500. And I said, look, you know, the network will chip in. I'll give $2,500 and we'll give him an 8-round fight and we'll bring this kid to New York and see what happens. So he acquiesced. So Friday night, we had an 8-round fighter with a guy named Sammy Scarf. It went 58 seconds, I believe, but ABC, WABC, WNBC, WCBS all had their trucks outside. It was a major New York sports story about this young kid. And it was a great success. 4,100 people that fell for him, not 400. So I went into work on Monday morning, and Jack Crumpy, who was the president of the Guard at that point, and Alan Fields, who was a COO, came to me and said that you are now in charge of boxing. So boxing now is under my wing, taken from Condon, and we worked hard to try and make it work. It was a difficult challenge, but it was a great experience. And boxing people are unique people, Doug, I will tell you.
Another huge success in your resume. Now it's time to talk about the Knicks, the other side of MSG other than the Rangers. You definitely knew that Pat Riley should stay with the Knicks, and it didn't happen. It didn't happen. You were a major deal maker, as you just talked about with your boxing there, but you couldn't convince everybody that Pat Riley was needed to be around for a championship to come to the Knicks. How about the background of that quickly that you would like to express? We don't want to give away everything that's in the book, obviously, but some of the things that when you look back on the Riley years and losing Pat Riley, what it meant to you and what it meant to MSG.
Well, I think it was a tremendous blow to Madison Square Garden. For me personally, I liked Pat, and I was gone, you know, by the time he made a decision to leave, but I just thought this was the one guy you do not let leave the building. And Dave Checkers, who was the president of the Knicks at that particular point, deserved great credit for getting Pat Riley in 1991 and bringing him over from NBC Showtime, NBC Sports, and making him coach of the Knicks. And Pat did an incredible job, as we all know. We lost the championship, you know, in the seventh game in 1994. But as that relationship continued to grow and the Garden continued to grow, Pat wanted more responsibility. He didn't want to be just the coach anymore. He really wanted to be the guy in charge. And that was very difficult and very hard to happen because Dave Checkers was the president of the Knicks, and he wasn't going to give Pat his job. So when the Garden was being sold, and I had conversations with Frank Biondi, who was a great guy, who was the head of Paramount, who was the head of Viacom, which now owned Madison Square Garden, I told him that there was a problem between this relationship, that it was going to eventually break apart, that Pat really wanted to be president. He wanted some equity also, which was never going to happen. And Dave was never going to want to relinquish that responsibility, which I understood, but that this was going to come to a hard ending. And I believed, even though the Garden is being sold, I told Biondi that I think that if I stayed by some chance, I would release Checkets and make Riley the head of the Knicks, because I believe that Riley was much more important to the Knicks than Checkets, although Checkets was very important and did a very, very good job in his tenure. Didn't happen. They became president, and eventually that relationship severed. And Pat Riley wanted more, couldn't get it, so he left. There's a lot more to the background story here in the book, through certain dialogues that occurred, but that was my belief, my thinking, and you weren't going to be able to keep both of them. And in my opinion, Riley was the more important one to keep, and Riley went off and I think proved that to many people, and the Knicks still haven't won a championship.
You were able to have intense relationships with some of the hardest working or maybe hardest people to deal with. And I know we only have about 8 minutes left in the show, but the apex of the story for you was you had an idea that eventually the Yankees would have their own network. And you have this relationship with the boss, George Steinbrenner. And he basically told you that if he ever did it, he would take care of you. But in the end, that really didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't, unfortunately. I had a good relationship with George. I call him an interesting bunch of guys. We made a very big deal that changed the regional sports business back in 1988, 89, when we took the Yankees away from our competitor Sports Channel, which was owned by Cablevision, our number one customer, and Chuck Dolan. And that was a big unraveling of the industry, to the point that for the first time ever, a baseball game was going to be on a basic regional network compared to pay. And we gave George $486 million through Paramount. And he appreciated that, obviously. And it really changed Madison Square Garden, Madison Square Garden Network, the value of the team and the value of the franchise. And we kept a good, strong relationship for a long time. And as I was doing due diligence for selling Madison Square Garden in 1994, Cablevision, who wound up buying it with AT&T, was very vocal that they were going to buy the Garden and they were going to crush George. And he would never get that kind of deal again, that $500 million 10-year deal. And I started to realize that George had a lot of leverage and that I believed it was the only team that really could start his own network. And even if he didn't, he had to make Cablevision believe that he would. And went to have breakfast with George after I left the Garden in 1995 and gave him this whole idea. And he really didn't get it in the beginning, because although George was very bright, he, the television cable industry and building a network was not something he was comfortable with. So we laid out memos, we laid out presentations. Mike Trager, Chet Simmons with me at many, many meetings in Florida. And we basically gave him this concept to start his own network. And even if he didn't, he had to make Cablevision think that he did. And they wound up, buying the Garden, not making a deal with George. George went off and started his own network called the Yes Network. We did not name it the Yes Network. Yeah, that was his name. We told him to get involved with the Nets, to get involved from the programming standpoint. And that was really the impetus for the Yes Network to go. And every time I saw George, he said he was a man of his word. What happened is he wound up getting ill. I understood not getting compensated at that particular point because there was no liquidity event for him. But then there came a liquidity event and I went back, and his illness really was much more serious than they were representing. I just wanted to go back and meet with him. And it's in a book and it details it pretty well. And Mike Trager, I think, for the first time, is able to come out and say it was absolutely Bob's idea. And I got screwed. But it was my own fault.
You were a trusting guy, Bob.
Yeah, I was. And we had a good relationship. And I believed George when I absolutely believed him when he shook my hand and gave me his word. And it wound up not being the case. And it was a lesson learned. It hurt financially, for sure, because a lot of people were taken care of that should not have been, certainly in front of me. But I learned a hard lesson. And if one thing in the book I could pass down to younger people is, if you get in situations like that, protect yourself better than I did. And sometimes a man's word in his handshake is not exactly what occurs. Still wound up, having a good relationship with George, and then they got ill and it was all over. And the SNEC was gone off to become a $4 billion asset.
Gut Punch is very candid. Right? There are people that you admit you did not have good relationships with. You mentioned those who you still to this day are. Were you worried about any kind of backlash or resentment that people might have after reading your book?
I don't think so. I think it's been 30 years. People have told me to write these stories for forever. And there's been a lot of misrepresentation on what actually happened. And I just felt it was time. It was cathartic for me. It was important for me to get the full story out. I say a lot of positive things about even people that, I struggle with from a relationship standpoint. And everywhere in the book is true. So, there was certainly comfort in my mind, comfort in Wally's mind. And it's just a true, honest story. And I'm probably more critical of myself than I am of anybody. And I think that was important to do. And it's just an honest take on an interesting, fascinating, long career that had a lot of good things to it and a lot of things that were unfortunate. And a lot of those things, were probably because I didn't play it correctly. So I'm very comfortable with it. It's honest. Every word is true. And people have really reacted positively to it. They like it. And for that, I'm pleased. And they say it's well written, and I believe it is. I think Wally did a terrific job. There's a smile on your face. Your career is, for the most part, although I do with my company Consult, it just documented a fascinating run and documented what goes on behind the scenes that fans never know about. And until a true story comes out, sometimes mistruths can continue.
A fascinating story, really, was to be in charge of Madison Square Garden in 1994 with the run from the Rangers and the run from the Knicks is something that maybe no one else will experience, Bob. So you were there at the best time. Both teams were good this year, didn't get to, to the pinnacle. I want to personally congratulate you for putting together, and I've told Sam this, if not the best, one of the best hockey broadcasting teams together with Sam Rosen and John Davidson. They were, I'm not even a Rangers fan, and I loved the way they covered the Ranger games. And when they won the cup, they made a point that there was that silver bearded guy or kind of darker bearded guy that was in the tuxedo was a big part of this. And so John Davidson, I know, is near and dear to your heart. Congratulations on this book, Bob. Gut Punch. You'll definitely want to check it out. And it is a, as I mentioned, not only just Bob's story, but it's a history about sports television and going all the way back, and even more, Live Nation wouldn't even have been created if it wasn't for Bob Gutkowski. Thanks so much for joining us on Sports Jam.
Doug, thank you so much. It was a pleasure and an honor, and enjoyed spending time with you.
Sports Jam is a WBGO Studios production. You can hear all the past shows by going to wbgo.org/sportsjam or wbgo.org/studios. You can also find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on the NPR list of podcasts or wherever you hear podcasts. Special thanks this week going out to Joe Favorito for hooking us up with Gut. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.